Thank you, Cindy, for excellent presentation. And Cindy, you worked for the Chamber of Commerce for a number of years, has a tourism background, and Dan obviously has worked on the technical side of these. Very good presentation. So we'll open it up for questions. Frank?
Do any of the presenters know approximately how much electrical production we could get if we, say, for example, set up a hydroelectric power plant part of the Highlight Dam? Is there enough water coming through there to be of any use? And the other question is, how many of the current windmills, the big windmills like you see near Harleton and the Judith Gap, how many would it take to provide the electricity that the Bozeman community uses? Ballpark?
You know, I don't have an exact number for you on the hydroelectric potential of Highlight. I can tell you from experience with similar projects, I, in a past life, spent some time with hydro as well, that it would be in the range of tens of megawatts. So 10, 20 megawatts possibly, probably closer to 10. That's, in the big picture, that's not a lot. The peak electrical use of our campus, for example, is right around 8 megawatts. So if we had a, if we were to do some level of hydro at Highlight, there may be some reasonable level of comparison to what the MSU campus requires, for example.
And the windmills?
Actually, I looked at that one quite closely. The wind field at Judith Gap is largely built out, except for 50 megawatts of capacity. And each one of those machines, I believe they're one or 1.5 megawatts per machine. So it's pretty impressive to think about when you drive through there that each one of those machines is putting out, Natalie might know what that equates to in residential units, but to power the MSU campus completely while the wind's blowing, we would need about 17 of those. Because they don't operate at 100% all the time. So you would need to have more than 7 megawatts of machine, about double that. And to make a substantial dent in the Montana state government, and I don't know how this would relate to Bozeman. Bozeman and MSU would be dramatically less than what all of state government would be. If we built out the remainder of that wind field, it would take care of a very large portion of state government. So we could certainly do Bozeman, I guess is where I'm going with that.
Solar
is very interesting. It's very expensive today. The energy input to produce photovoltaic arrays is quite high. The energy input and the chemical processes are both something that question the actual environmental sensitivity of the production of solar. That said, once you get solar in place, it operates beautifully for a very long time. 25 years is a life you hear a lot. I think the systems will last much longer than that. Will it ever factor in at our latitude? A lot of people would say, you know, it's too cold, we have too much cloud. But I think I'm right on this. I think Germany is the largest single solar installer in the world. And if you've been there, they have horrible weather. Much less sun than what we have. So, I believe that in the future, solar will be a bigger player, and especially large solar fields that could occur in the southern latitudes of the United States. you know, through the Sun Belt, basically. I think there's a lot of opportunity for large-scale solar installation. There's a lot of opportunity for small-scale installations, too. There's just an economy of scale. The smaller you get, the more expensive it's going to be to produce that.
I have a question for Cindy. Could you give us the status of the thinking on building dams, either Sourdough or Highlight, since it came up earlier, just where we are in that?
Sure, the question was about dams, and where we are in that is that we have an integrated water resource plan, and we just had a report on that at the last Monday night's meeting. So we have hired a firm to really help us look at a lot of alternatives, including a dam, so maybe the dam on one end and alternatives on the other. And we're going to go through a process where we really evaluate what all the alternatives are for us to meet our future water needs. And so I believe it's about, I want to say, 12 to 18-month process. There will be an opportunity for public input. We are looking at a task force that includes folks that have an understanding of this kind of water at all different levels that will be involved in reviewing the scope of work. So I would say that the idea of looking at how we meet those water needs is moving ahead, and whether that's a dam, whether that comes out to be a dam or something else, that's where we are at the moment.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'd like to comment on solar electricity. The embodied energy that it takes to produce solar panels, solar electric panels, is generally recouped in 2 years. So after the second year, you've got a net gain in energy. The other thing on a residential scale right now, solar electricity has become very affordable. It's not really expensive, but that's mostly because of the grants and the rebates right now, and it's also because the Chinese got into panel manufacture very heavily 5 years ago, and the cost of panels is half of what they were 5 years ago. And Northwestern Energy has very good grants available, and as well as 30% federal tax credits and $1,000 state tax credits. So actually putting a solar electric system on your house today in Bozeman, you can do it for less than $4,000 for a panel size system.
Thank you.
I'm curious about the buildings on campus. It seems the newer ones would be more energy efficient. Is it because they're laboratories and they're using a lot of the old ones? I mean, are so drafty and just lose so much.
You know, it's a great question. Part of the issue is that a lot of our newest buildings are laboratory buildings. And laboratory buildings are very intensive from the ventilation standpoint. You need to control experiments, either to protect the experiment or protect the experimenter. And that requires a lot of air. But we've had a lot of success recently with implementing new technology in some of our buildings that have dramatically reduced those energy costs. So we're really focused on the laboratory buildings and reducing their energy throughput. The other reason that buildings in general have become more energy intensive is because we, today, we understand now that people, occupants of buildings, require a certain standard of indoor air quality. So that requires that we bring air in and we condition it. We have grown accustomed to having our spaces between 68 and 72. Some of us want it 68 all year, some of us want it 78 all year. And that, from an overall society-related issue, the ability to inexpensively acquire air conditioning is one of our big issues as a world. I mean, air conditioning is extremely energy intensive, and we see it being not even considered a an option in a lot of cases anymore. People expect that be done. And I'm making commentary outside of MSU's campus at this point. So we see a lot of commercial buildings being designed with air conditioning, and I question that. I question whether we need to be doing that to the extent that we are. We live here in Bozeman. We all know what the power and throwing some windows open at night and turning on a whole house fan will do for you. It'll probably freeze you out most of the months of the year. The need for air conditioning, or the use of air conditioning, is air conditioning is overused. Is I guess where I'm trying to go with that. We need to dial that back.
Surely.
I have a question about the efficiency of the, I mean, if it's 30% at the plant for every day, is there potential to improve that sort of thing and then, you know, transportation and storage?
You know, there some of the newest coal-fired plants are upwards of 45% efficient. So the central energy system is becoming more efficient. Some may say it's becoming less bad from that standpoint. To make the leaps in energy efficiency of delivered electricity that I believe we need to make, I believe it's going to result in smaller plants, something called combined heat and power. For example, if I were to, on our campus, be able to find a way to produce a large portion of our own electricity. And a lot of times electricity comes along with the production of a large amount of heat. And then we can entrain that heat into a process that we can use, because we use a lot of heat all year long on campus. We could take that delivered electricity, which right now is coming to us at about 20% efficiency, and we could change that cycle so we're using 80 to 90% of the energy in that cycle, because one of the biggest issues is that a central coal-fired plant, for example, there is no use for all of the heat that comes off of those. I'm sure most of you have seen those plants. There's a tremendous amount of heat that comes off of those plants, and it is dissipated in the air because there's nowhere to really go with it. And so we're actually looking at that right now. We're assessing the construction of expanded heat and power production on campus, not only because of the efficiency. Again, you have to think of the Gandhi, Patton, Muir approach. We see doing that substantially making our system more durable, because we are a research institution at this point. We have processes happening on campus which really cannot stop. If they stop, a tremendous amount of research can be lost. And we have ice samples in Cobley Hall that are millions and millions of years old. And so that piece of ice is very expensive, and it's hard to replicate. So there are a lot of reasons to do it, but one of them is to improve the overall source efficiency of our energy.
Are there any questions for Cindy? Yeah, Linda?
I'm wondering, with regard to idling, did you figure out where the most idling occurs? I'm guessing stoplights.
You know, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm going to turn to Natalie to see if she had. Do you know where have we? Our anti-idling group is just getting formed. I imagine it's something they'll look into. But do you know from your work where the most idling occurs?
From what we understand, the most critical idling is occurring around the schools, but then also in a certain location in the northeast neighborhood, where semi-trucks are idling all night long. But I think that this group will look at systems and what the city of Bozeman can do to better coordinate lights and prevent traffic idling to the extent possible. But there's a lot of other factors that go into traffic synchronization.
So did everybody hear most idling for what they're finding occurs around schools and in some areas of the community where we have large semis idling more often than other places in the community, and the task force will be looking into this and looking at systems to maybe help to mitigate some of that.
Just a quick follow-up on that. With the roundabout at 11th and College, has there been any comparison or any energy usage between the roundabout and four stop signs?
The question is, has there been any comparison with the round, with regard to the roundabout and stoplights and stop signs? And again, I'm going to turn to Natalie to see if she might know, because I don't. And maybe Dan knows, too. I don't know.
We've not done an energy comparison. Traffic flow is definitely tremendously
I think it's generally agreed that traffic circle like that will save energy and more efficient flow of traffic if it's designed properly. I admit I was a little bit of a skeptic. My wife's on the Justin Traffic Safety Committee. She was a big fan. Being in England where I didn't know how to use them, I was a skeptic, but I'm convinced that it was a very good solution at 11th and College.
I think from whatever, all the feedback we've gotten, it's been a good solution. Natalie, do you have any more to add to that?
I think Brian Houston actually did look at some of those numbers, and I don't remember the specifics, but it was a vast improvement. I think those numbers, if anyone's really interested
in. Or one of our city engineers, Brian, Natalie thinks, has looked at that, and I'm sure it's something that this the anti-idling task force will be looking at as well.
That's a picture of something in the Chronicle about the energy savings.
There was.
I just had a quick comment about something that people can do in their own homes. This past year, as a result of the hail that we had 2 years ago, our church got a new roof, but we had enough money left over to replace some 50-year-old furnaces with high-efficiency furnaces. At the same time, we took out the 50-gallon water heater that was powered by gas, realizing that we only had the church open 2 days a week. So we got a 6-gallon water heater that turns itself on and off during the days that we're not there. Just this January, my wife and I got a new washer and dryer. The washer only fills water to the level of the clothes. You just push a button and it automatically does it. The dryer has heat sensors and moisture sensors that tell you that the clothes are dry and shuts the machine off. Just those little things just really convinced me that there's a tremendous amount we can do individually.
Thank you.
I guess that's one kind of a correlated question is on your education initiative, portion of your initiative, what is there anything being done to get information out to the public on things we can do individually, either in the generation of power on an individual basis or conservation?
Well, I can say the answer to that is yes. And we, in the Education and Outreach Committee, we have met 3 times now, and so that is part of our plan to talk about how we do the best job that we can in getting this information out to the public, educating the public. And so that is a work in progress, and you will be seeing something shortly on that. But it's certainly something that's on our radar, and we look at that every time we meet. That's our main mission. And I see the education and outreach part of this going all through when the anti-idling committee comes up with whatever it is they're going to come up with, and benchmarking committee, and all these committees that we'll have, that the education and outreach committee will be working through to help push that information out to the public in the best way that we can. So thanks for that question.
Can you explain what you mean by the benchmarking process?
That was the process within commercial buildings where you look at how much energy is sort of flowing out of your building and what you can do to make that so that you're not wasting a lot of energy, and how do you do some retrofitting, and how do you build new buildings so that energy is not sort of escaping out. So you have this benchmark that said here's a level to which is sort of acceptable in terms of where we're conserving energy, and here's a level to which we want to not exceed because too much energy is escaping out of them, the way that I understand it, which is rather elemental.
Cindy, I'd add to that. Remember this is our energy efficiency per building. This is benchmarking, basically. And each of these is really showing us how much energy per square foot per year our buildings use. And
it's as simple as that, understanding what the annually what the health of your building is and how it's operating.
Do you have an entry on that for the new stadium lights?
I was waiting for the lights. No. We don't have a stadium light entered there yet. Well, we'll next year, though.
And how many hours a year does it take to negate all those?
You know, the lights are interesting. We have a new system on campus that we're still, as many of you know, figuring out how it's going to be handled. From the standpoint of how many hours is it on and when does it turn on during the day, that can really, when we turn it on, really affects how much it means energy-wise to campus. If we turn it on at 5:15 on game day, for example, it doesn't have a huge energy effect. Well, when you look at the actual consumption of the system, it's not as much as you would think it would be. It's about a 300 kilowatt system. And when you look at how much impact that system's going to have, it's purely about operating hours. How many hours a year are we going to have it on? And if we can really dial that in and nail that down, that's what we have to do. Right now, I know it's a big issue in town, because when it's on and doesn't have there's no apparent reason for it to be on, it does cause a substantial night glow, and that's a big issue for energy, but also night sky pollution.
So Dan,
we're working through that.
Is part of the reason it's on now just testing it out, the system?
It's I think, Jarvis, it's testing it out. It's demonstrating it to different parties that may be using it at different times. And I've got to tell you the truth, I don't know why it's on every time it's on. Because largely that's governed by event services and athletics. I can tell you this, we are meeting to discuss this very thing in the next couple weeks. I don't have the meeting set yet. But from two perspectives, I'm very concerned from the energy perspective. If you turn it on at the wrong time of the day, it can set the peak demand for campus, and that's a bad thing.
Right.
Economically, that's a bad thing.
Fortunately, it won't get much use in the daytime.
I sure hope not. Because, during peak hours, if we turn it on, then a bad thing has happened to our energy bill. So, but the other reason that we need to meet is to talk through this very subject. We need to be very conscientious about when the system is on. And we should know and be very conservative about how often we have that system on. I believe that as a person who lives half a mile from the university.
Just one or two more. Need to wrap it up, I think.
Is it possible to have the cost of those lights a direct charge on the energy services budget?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Is it possible to make the charge of using those lights a direct charge to the energy services budget?
Oh,
change, who cares?
The event services?
Mm-hmm.
You bet, and that's already been done.
Yeah.
So they are charged, and that's a non-state budget, so it's paid for by ticket sales and other event sales.
You've been very patient. Go ahead.
All right, well, when Dan had the word CO2 on his graph, Dan said the word carbon. Now, carbon dioxide is a beneficial element in the air. It's essential to both the human metabolism and plants. Do mechanical engineers just use interchangeably carbon and carbon dioxide?
Well, carbon dioxide is the media by which carbon is entrained into our atmosphere. And that's why, we do shorten it to carbon, all too often, but carbon dioxide is one of the three primary greenhouse gases that we're typically concerned about.
And the other two?
Are methane.
Hydrofluorocarbons or not?
Yeah, and that's probably the best way to put it, is hydrofluorocarbons. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's such as refrigerants primarily, isn't it?
Primarily refrigerants, yeah. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much for excellent presentation. I'm sure that if you have additional questions, then there are a couple of handouts for this from the university. Thank you for coming.